Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
One of the most basic halachas in Judaism is the halacha of Shechita. We've recently discussed in halacha boot camp that the source for the mitzvah of Shechita is very, very elusive. As a matter of fact, the only reference to Shechita is a pasuk in Devarim where the pasuk says, when you want to shecht your own animals, you should do it kasher tzivasicha, as I have commanded you. But if you then search in the entire Torah, you will not see any mention of how it is that I commanded you. Meaning Hashem says, shecht those animals the way I commanded you. There's no mention of that command. And yet you're chayav malchus if you eat an animal that wasn't appropriately shechted. Clearly, this is just one indication of the Torah Shebiksav being based on the Torah Shebal Peh, meaning the written Torah is the cryptic form, the very abbreviated form built on the entire Torah Shebal Peh. As a matter of fact, Rav Hirsch, the famous Rav Hirsch, explains it that basically when you're attending a lecture, if you hear a long, complicated lecture and you write down the cryptic notes after, if you've attended the lecture, you read the notes, it's clear and obvious what the meaning is. If you haven't attended a lecture, the notes are meaningless. So too, there are many, many mitzvahs that are either cryptic or to be misunderstood if you read them just on the Torah Shebiksav. The understanding is that it's all based on the oral Torah, on the Torah Shebal Peh, and everything is integrated as one whole. Now, that is an important point to focus on, because unfortunately, huge segments of our nation are ignorant of that fact. There are, unfortunately, 90% of our own people who are not religious, and huge, huge amounts of those people either deny completely Torah Shebal Peh, deny partially that it's legitimate or from Hashem, etc. So it's an important point to focus on and understand that Torah Shebiksav without Torah Shebal Peh makes no sense. It won't just lead to misinterpretations, but literally cannot be read. You cannot read the Torah. You can't read the Chumash without the Torah Shebal Peh. It's not whole. It makes no sense. But the ironic part is that it's not a modern phenomenon to question the validity of Torah Shebal Peh. It's something that began way, way back in history. As a matter of fact, the first person to do it was none other than Korach. Korach claimed that Moshe Rabbeinu was fabricating huge segments of the Torah. Korach claimed that Moshe Rabbeinu was making this stuff up on his own without God's direction. He was just inventing this stuff and it had no basis. And it's very interesting to note that Korach began his machlokas with that focus, and that machlokas where he and the 250 heads of Sanhedrin stood up against Moshe and stood up against Hashem was predicated on the basis that Moshe Rabbeinu was inventing things, and again, their demise was quite ugly, and they ended their life in a very, very disastrous way. Now, Rashi explains to us that Korach was particularly motivated for a machlokas. His motivation was that he was not chosen to be the Nasi, someone else was chosen to be the head of the Shevet, and he felt that he was slighted, he was overlooked, and he said, I am going to be Mevatel Moshe. I'm going to disprove Moshe, I'm going to annul everything that he said. And that part, I guess, is understandable. The man had an agenda, he had an ego, he had an issue, an axe to grind. But the question is, how did he get the 250 heads of Sanhedrin to join him? Now, these were people of very, very high stature, very learned, very great. They didn't have an axe to grind. And not only did Korach lead them in the rebellion, he actually convinced them of the fact that Torah Shebaal Peh is not based. Moshe Rabbeinu is fabricating this stuff. And the question is, how did he get them to believe in this? Now, there is a Rashi that explains to us that his strategy was interesting. Ma'asa, what he did, Hamad Rekonas Reish Nun Roshi Sanhedrin, he got together 250 heads of Sanhedrin, most of them from Shevet Ruvain. They were great people. What did he do? Elbisham Talisa Shukulan Tchelis. He put on them a beged, a garment that was completely made of Tchelis. Tchilis is wool that's dyed that sort of blue-purple color. We're not sure now exactly what the color is. But on each of these great people, he put a beged, a garment that was completely dyed Tchilis color. And they stood in front of Moshe, and they said as follows, a talis that's made completely of Tchilis, is it obligated in tzitzit or not? That was a question they asked Moshe Benu. Moshe answered, it's obligated. Immediately they began laughing. They began laughing at Moshe, and they said, is it possible that if a garment is made of, say, cotton, one strand of tchilis patters the entire garment, takes off the obligation of the entire garment? How is it possible that a garment that's completely made of tchilis could possibly need tzitzits? Therefore, they began laughing at Moshe, and that was the beginning of the rebellion, proving that Moshe was inventing this stuff because it's too ridiculous to be true. And the problems with this Rashi are a bit obvious. And the first problem is that the question is a bit difficult to understand, meaning, is a garment that's completely made of tchilis obligated in tzitzits or not? I don't know. It's a good question. But I don't even hear the covenant. Well, if a cotton garment, one strand of tchilis takes off its obligation, surely if the entire garment is made of tchilis, surely it's not obligated in tzitzit? I'm not sure. I don't know. It's a hard kalvachomer to hear. And the question definitely is not that potent. But if you want to start asking questions, that is not the question that you're going to ask on the Torah. If you want to ask questions, there are far more powerful, far more penetrating questions to ask. And I'll share one obvious one with you. Here is the halacha. Every single individual, from the Kohen who shechs the animal, to the Kohen who brings the blood, from the Kohen who burns it, all the way down the line, every Kohen who's involved with the processing of the Parah Aduma becomes tamei. Yet the water, the mechatas that comes out, is a water that's actually needed and makes one tar, makes one pure. Everyone involved becomes impure, yet this is the process of creating the water that's the purifying water. I know that's a very powerful question, because the Medrash tells us that the wisest of all men, Shlomo HaMelech, could not fathom that pella. That is a very strong question. If you want to disprove Moshe, that's the question you ask, the most obvious, powerful question, and it's not the only one. If you study, not even very deeply into the Torah, you'll find many deep, powerful questions, but tchilis is not it. Yet this question, for some reason, becomes such a pivotal point in the machlokas that it disproved in their minds Moshe's validity, disproved Torah Shebal Peh, and it brought them to their death. And the question is, what was the nature of this question? What was the big deal? What is Rashi telling us here? And I'd like to see if we can answer this evening. And to do this, I'd like to share with you an interesting idea. In Paris, in 1895, the Lumiere brothers, who were pioneers in photography, showed publicly the first movie that was ever shown to man. This was a small sort of fair, and some adventuresome souls came into this little room. The room was dark, and the Lumiere brothers were showing for the first time in history a moving picture. Now, the actual movie clip was of a train coming into the station. The Lumiere brothers had positioned their camera here, and you could see the train first in a distance, very small, and as it comes closer, it looms larger, 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 until it looks like the train actually crashes into the movie camera because it sort of just loses focus as it comes to you. Okay, the crowd is gathered, the lights are put down, they show the movie, and the movie ends. Would you like to know the audience's reaction to the first movie in history? You'd be hard-pressed to get their reaction because the majority of them were screaming in terror, climbing under their chairs. And the reason was because this was the first time they had ever experienced this, and they saw a train, oh my goodness, a train, coming at them. They began screaming, and they climbed under their chairs in terror. And the point, my friends, is that context makes a big difference in interpretation. seeing certain facts, seeing certain stimuli will not give you the same impression if you have a different context, if you have a different understanding. And what their issue was that they couldn't remove the train from the reality of a train coming at you. They had no ability to put the scene into context. And as a result, that brought them to terror. Okay, one more interesting example. In the beginning of the second war, the current war in Iraq, there was a very interesting event that had occurred. A heavily armed American platoon was approaching a mosque. Now, their mission was actually a peacekeeping mission. They were looking to enlist the local cleric to help them in the distribution of relief foods and various supplies. They came to the mosque again to ask the cleric for help. And on their approach, the word spread to the Muslims that the American troops are coming. And hundreds of Muslims came out screaming with their hands in their air, ranting, raving, attempting to chase away the American troops. Now, here was the problem. An armed platoon cannot back off against unarmed men. It would destroy the morale of the entire U.S. armed forces and would send a terrible, terrible message. On the other hand, they can't stand their ground because it means shooting up innocent civilians and sending a very worse message to the Iraqis that the Americans are butchers. So what do they do? And this very, very dangerous situation was in the very first days of the landing. Interesting enough, the commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Hughes, was a quick-thinking individual. He picked up the megaphone and commanded, "Soldiers, take a knee," which means to bend down on one knee, which is a combat position. He then commanded them, "Point your rifles at the ground." And then he said the most perplexing command probably ever issued by a commanding U.S. officer. He said, "Gentlemen, now smile." And to a man, everyone in the platoon went like this. And people on the scene said the whole situation changed dramatically. The Muslims, from waving and screaming, put their arms down. They looked, they smiled back. And then they went over, they started patting the soldiers on the back, and the whole tension, hostility, the potential murder was abated and stopped. But it wasn't just stopped, the mood was so radically changed, so quickly changed by one small move. There are certain forces in this world that have the ability to change a mood, change the tension, change the hostility, very quickly. One such phenomena that we have is something called laughter. If you're ever involved in a hostile situation, if you're in a contentious environment and something funny happens, a coffee cup spills, somebody trips, and people start laughing, you could feel it like dissipate. The anger, the tension just disappears, and people feel very, very differently about the whole situation. Laughter is an amazing power, and you could almost feel it like the release of static electricity. When you rub your feet on the ground, on the carpet in the winter, and then you touch something metal, there's a release. There are many times when you have a tense situation and people just laugh, the tension just disappears, the whole scene changes, there's a release, and everyone's relaxed and easy. What changes is the understanding, the interpretation, the context. If you'd like to know what Korach was doing, he was not asking questions on Moshe Rabbeinu. The Das HaKeinim is very clear. He invited these 250 Roshi Sanhedrin to his house, and he made a party. When he put these begadim on them, he said, "Gentlemen, I'm going to show you something very, very humorous." There was a spirit of celebration. They were drinking. They were happy. And he said, "I'm going to show you something very humorous." He said, "Watch this." And when the Roshi Sanhedrin went into Moshe Rabbeinu, they were not coming in to ask a question. They were coming in to mock. They were coming in with an act of derision. They were coming in to laugh. And what laughter does is changes the entire situation. Laughter can take a person of great, great respect and change the whole attitude. when you laugh at a person, what you're doing is taking away the respect that you have for him. You're changing the context, and you could feel the natural respect and tension that was there before dissipate. And much like when that commanding officer said to smile, the tension abated, so too, when the Rosh Sanhedrin began laughing at Moshe, the respect, the honor, the greatness of Moshe was destroyed in their eyes. And at that point, there was nothing left. At that point, everything that Moshe said was now hushed, was now suspect, because he was no longer the man who he once was. He was no longer on that high pedestal. He was whatever. And laughter has a very powerful, deleterious, damaging effect. It's called leitzanus. And what leitzanus does is it takes away the gravity, takes away the severity. And when you laugh at something, it changes completely the context and takes away the seriousness of it. And in that perspective, leitzanus is very dangerous. And Rav Chaim Shmulevitz mentions this here on this Rashi as something to be very careful about. And while that's true, that laughter, mockery, is a very, very dangerous phenomena, it also is a very, very important tool in a successful person's box of techniques for dealing with life. And I'll share with you what I mean. My job sometimes takes me to places that I'd rather not be. One of them is not long ago when I found myself in the psychiatric ward speaking to a young man who I've had many conversations with before, but this time the conversation was a bit different because the conversation was circling on the fact that this fellow was not taking his meds. And I asked him, why aren't you taking your medication? The doctors feel that this is what you need, this will help you. Now, he was there in the hospital on suicide watch. And clearly we're dealing with a very serious situation, and I was very concerned about the fact he wasn't taking his meds. And I was also a bit surprised when he said to me this line. He said, those medicines, who knows what's in them? I'm very careful about my health. I wouldn't take medicine without being very certain. Because we were friendly, and we've had many conversations before, I asked him, I hope you don't mind if I'm a bit rude. He said, no. I said, would you excuse me for pointing out that suicide is also bad for your health? If you go to a high roof, jump off and splatter, that can have a very deleterious effect on your general health, maybe even more than certain antidepressants. But here's the point. He was a sane person. But would you like to know why he was engaging in that sort of ununderstandable behavior? It's because there were two sides to him. When he was in a good mood, he was very careful about what he ate, very careful about exercise, because life is valuable. When he became depressed, it didn't matter. And not only didn't it matter, but what's it worth? A whole thing doesn't matter, and he might well have committed suicide. And the reality is that moods have a very, very powerful effect on us. If you've ever spoken to a clinically depressed person, you'll find nothing moves them. Tell a person, you know, I hate to be rude here, but the building is burning. Okay. You're going to die. If you sit there, you're going to die. All right. No, you're going to die a painful death. You're going to be a crisp piece of toast. All right. You think I should move? Yeah, I think you should move. Okay. But when you're dealing with a person who's depressed, nothing moves them because nothing matters. And moods greatly affect the value that we place on things. Now, clearly, that person I mentioned before had a mood disorder, but for all of us, if you pay attention, your moods will greatly shape the value that you place on things, your moods will greatly shape your feelings about things, and your moods will also greatly affect your effectiveness and ability to be a productive individual. And that is something that I think is very important to focus on. I'd like to share with you, Daniel Goleman, in his book Social Intelligence, makes a very powerful point. He says that he has an acquaintance of his who got married late in life, and they were very well-to-do, and he visited them in their Upper West Side apartment, and they had a child, a young child, and he said there was no expense that they spared in buying this child everything, castle-like dollhouses, every toy imaginable. And in this girl's life, there was only one thing missing: friends. They would not allow their daughter to play with friends. She was 4 or 5 years of age. There were no play dates, no friends. Why? Because they subscribe to the theory that a child is very susceptible to damages of criticism. And if their little darling might play with another friend, maybe the friend would reject her, maybe the friend would criticize her, there'd be some words, and they were afraid for the psyche of their little darling, so they wouldn't allow her to ever play with friends. Now, besides the perverseness of that type of life, his point as a clinical psychologist is that they were doing a grave disservice to their daughter. Why? Because he says one of the most important lessons that a child learns in the young age is how to regulate your moods. When someone insults you, how to get back into the game and play, even though someone said something nasty. When someone does you a disservice, even though you're in a bad mood, how to pick yourself back up, regulate your moods, and go about your life. And he says if a child doesn't learn that at a young, tender age, then they're going to be crippled for life. Because if you don't learn to handle setbacks, if you don't learn to handle adversity, if you don't learn to regulate your moods and be able to go on with life, then what's going to happen is invariably you're going to have setbacks, trials, tribulations, and you're not going to be able to pick yourself back up into the game, and you will have a tremendous problem being an effective person. Being able to regulate your moods, being able to control your moods, is a very key part of being a successful person. And I got to feel this myself up front and personal, as they say, very recently. 2 Shabbosim ago, I was in Chicago for Shabbos, and I had a fantastic time. I was speaking at a Beis Yaakov Shabbaton there, and being a boys' high school Rebbe for many years, it was an experience that I wasn't ready for. Number one, I spoke 6 times on Shabbos, and each time the girls were listening. Listening and interested and asking questions and talking out. I was like, wow. I had a great time. It was fun. Not only did I really, really enjoy the Shabbos, right before Shabbos, an old acquaintance of mine, actually an old Talmud of mine, had asked me if we could get together Sunday before I go back to New York. I said, sure. We went out for lunch and we began talking. I asked him what's doing, his kids, the family situation. After a good while, he asked me about TBT. I said, good, Baruch Hashem, things are going very well. We're growing, expanding, many guys involved, etc. He said, what about the financial piece? Well, we got a pretty big deficit. And I told him the number of the deficit. He looked at me and said, well, how about if I take on, and he made a very, very large pledge, at which point I said, okay, yeah, I could, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, I could live with that. Yeah. And needless to say, I was very happy. It was a great Shabbos. A nice piece of the financial problem was alleviated. I went to the airport in a very, very buoyant, joyful mood. And then I missed my plane. And I was not a happy camper. Because missing the plane meant that I blew my schedule. I hadn't seen my kids in a couple of days now. And I had a lot of things to do. And I was angry, very, very angry at me. And I was beating myself up. Why didn't you move quicker? Why didn't you go quicker? What did you do? You get response. And I was literally beating myself up. I tried waiting for the next plane. I tried learning a little bit, but I was pretty uptight, pretty upset. The more I waited, the more upset I became. When I'm waiting for the last plane that evening to leave Chicago, and it's becoming clear that despite the fact that I'm on standby, I'm not getting on that plane, I was pretty, pretty angry. And what's making it even worse is I'm still waiting and I'm trying to learn, and there's a couple next to me who are gabbing and going on, and I reach for my noise-canceling headphones, and I put them on, and I realize the battery's dead, and that's it. I am gone. Arrgh! There's a sharper image across the way, and I must have been scowling when I walked in there, and I asked the fella behind the counter, could I buy a AAA battery? I guess he realized I wasn't having a good day, and he said, nah. Here's 2. Take them on me. And I said, wow. And I said these words. I said, you know, I missed my plane. I'm sleeping in Chicago tonight. I blew a major, major obligations I had. And I was in such a bad mood. And you made me so happy. And my mood changed in a radical way. I was joyful, buoyant, and happy. And here's the point. Had you met me in the earlier stage, I would have had a difficult time being a mensch. If my wife met me, if my kids met me, I would have had a difficult time being what I want to be, acting as I should. One small act, one small little thing, and changes back my mood to where it should be. And my friends, here's the punchline. You don't need to wait for somebody to do an unusual favor to you. There is a tool that the human being has at his fingertips, at his command. It's called laughter. If you're in a bad mood, you're upset, life is not going your way, and you learn to laugh at those sort of things that happen. You learn to take a lighthearted, casual approach, and you actually laugh at it. What happens is your moods change. If you ask the scientists, they'll tell you all of the various neurotransmitters that change. They'll tell you the various physiological effects. But the bottom line is you go from sullen blackness to joy and happiness, and you're a much, much more effective human being. And that ability to regulate your moods has a huge impact on A, your effectiveness as a human, B, your ben adam l'chaveru. It carries through many, many things and is a tremendous tool. I was a Talmud of the Reshiva, and Blachier, I cannot tell you how many times the Reshiva would walk in telling jokes, laughing. Not just that, the Reshiva would tell us on a regular basis, you must have a sense of humor. You have to have a sense of humor. The Reshiva told us to us publicly, and told me many times privately, he would say, you have to have a sense of humor, you must have a sense of humor. At the time, I was young, and I didn't understand the value or the importance of it. I figured, whatever, the Reshiva says so, you have to do it. And as I got older in life, I began to understand the value and importance of it, and I'll share with you why. My wife has an expression that when you see the person with the perfect life, what that means is you don't know what's going on in their life. Because every human being has issues, problems, setbacks, trials, tribulations. Everyone has tzaras. And if you see the person with the ideal life, all it means is you don't know what's going on. Because everybody, no matter who you are, you're going to have issues, troubles, there are going to be things going on. But this is the key. How you deal with those things will vastly determine A, who you are, how you react, how you deal with people, and your general effectiveness as a human being. Learning this skill called laughter, learning how to laugh, learning how to take a humorous attitude towards things vastly changes your mood. Because when you're down and depressed, nothing means anything. When you're black and just feeling ugly, things don't have the same value. People don't have the same value. Relationships don't have the same value. But you tell a joke, you find something funny, you laugh, and you're in a new mood. And in that new mood, everything is different. Much like a fellow who was on suicide watch, when he was in a good mood, life was precious. When he was depressed, nothing had value. That's us on a microcosmic level. We may not hit the highs and the lows the way that person does, but the reality is when you're in a bad mood, things don't have the value. When you're in a good mood, they do. And the key to so much of it is learning how to laugh, learning how to take a lighthearted approach to it. And what the Reshiva was saying was that adage in the world that he who laughs lasts is very accurate and very valuable. And that's the importance of laughter in your own life. But there is another element to it that may be even more important, and that is in your relationships with others. What I mean by that is the way you relate to your wife, your kids, your coworkers, your boss, your employees. You see, invariably there are going to be situations of tension, pressure, hostility. If you can cultivate, hone, and practice a good sense of humor, what happens is you alleviate so much of that tension, pressure, and all of the various problems that come along with it. Much like that commanding officer who said, smile, and the hostility just dissipated. You could feel palpable difference. The Muslims were no longer screaming, ranting, raving. They were now patting the backs of Americans. A joke, a lightheaded remark, something that's casual but humorous can change vastly. That relationship, the tension, the hostility, it just dissipates, and it's a whole new relationship, and oftentimes much easier, much better. And, my friends, successful people practice this. successful people practice this on a regular basis. There are few people I know who are as focused and value the preciousness of a moment as Rabbi Harris, Rosh Yeshiva now in Forest Hills and Kugan Hills. And I was a Talmud, and I remember as a single fellow, I was sitting at breakfast when Rabbi Harris said, "Barry, tell me a joke." Now, Rabbi Harris was very serious, very focused, a major masmid, and a very serious person. When he said, "Barry, tell me a joke," I was like, am I missing something? Like, and he explained to me that he had now taken on a tremendous amount of responsibilities. He had moved from Rochester to then Forest Hills. He was acting as Rosh Yeshiva. He was also acting as Menahel. He was also very involved in the finances of the Yeshiva. And he had been dealing with quite a number of parents, and he felt under a huge amount of pressure, and he just needed to laugh. Now, he made a mistake because he asked me to tell a joke. That was not the right one to ask. But the bottom line is that understanding that there are times when it's a very effective cure for the mood, for the tension, for the pressure. When you laugh, it's a very different sense that you have, and you go then about your life in a very different way. By the way, one of the most effective human beings in the 20th century was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan would begin every speech with a quip, with a joke. People assumed that he was doing it to loosen up the crowd. And he once explained that it has nothing to do with the crowd. It's for me. When I tell a joke and I laugh, I become relaxed. I become more at ease. Now here's a man who began his career as an actor, and then went into politics, was speaking in public time after time, day after day, and was so used to the crowd, but there was a certain sort of tension, a certain unease when he'd be in front of a new crowd. Telling a joke loosened him up, and he began every speech that way, because successful human beings understand the importance towards myself, the importance to the relationship. It's a tool that develops, helps, and greatly enhances your life. Now, the next part of the schmooze is going to hurt me a little bit, but I'm doing it anyway. There were these two muffins baking in an oven. And one of them yells, "Wow, it's hot in here." And the other muffin replies, "Holy cow, a talking muffin." No one laughed. No one here laughed. Now, why is that interesting? Because CNN did a study, and in 2002, this was voted by 40,000 people as the funniest joke. And I told that joke, and nobody laughed. And that painful lesson was brought home to me, not here, but in my high school teaching career. I would write material for Shmuzim that was dead funny, hilarious, really, really fall on the floor, side-cracking funny. And I'd get up to perform it as part of Shmuz in front of high school, and the guys would sit there and go, and I would say something like, "It was a joke, guys." Oh. And I know it was hilarious material. How do I know? Because Chazaras HaShmuz was the next day. The Shmuz was Wednesday. Thursday was Chazaras HaShmuz. One of the guys would say over the Shmuz in cheer. And he would say over the same routine, same words, and the guys would be falling on the floor laughing. Literally laughing. But he said the same words, same expressions. When he said it, the guys were falling all over themselves. When I said it, deadpan silence. From that experience, I learned a very important lesson. And that is, even if you can't tell a joke, that doesn't mean you should not practice having a sense of humor. You should not utilize humor, quite the opposite. You don't have to be Jackie Mason. You don't have to be the funniest guy in North America to value the importance of a sense of humor, to still tell jokes, to still have that lighthearted sense. And the value of it comes even if you're not a stand-up comedian. Because humor, practicing a sense of humor, honing a sense of humor, using it, is a tool that even if you're not a natural comic, can and should be used. Now, I guess maybe you should be careful, because if you're talking not funny and you make jokes. Matter of fact, I knew there was a certain very serious major Talmud Chacham who was giving a Beis Medrash Lev Ashir, and he was a Talmud of the Rosh Yeshiva, and he would tell jokes, and they really weren't funny. And at a certain point, it was a bazillion, because, like, But the point is, even if you're not very funny, the concept is practicing, engaging, using humor as a tool for success in life. It works for yourself, it works for relationships, and I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from Korach. And what Korach did was, he destroyed a human being. The power of laughter is such that the respect... Moshe Rabbeinu was the single most important man in that generation. The respect that he was held in everyone's eyes was unimaginable. And the only thing that could destroy that image, that respect, was laughter. Because when you laugh, when you mock, it changes the value, radically changes the whole scene, and that is the danger, the damage of Leitzonis. Do you know why it is that weak comics can only get their laughs with off-colored humor? Because certain issues that are taboo have this sort of like electric sort of sense. We don't talk about it. And when they sort of touch it, it's like a shock. It's like a... That's half the humor, because they're dealing with a grave, serious situation, a taboo subject, in a way that they really shouldn't be. And what they're doing is exactly this point, changing the context, changing the value, and that is the power of humor. And when that movie, Train, showed the train coming at it, the people in that first movie experience didn't have context. The stimuli itself is not the issue, it's interpretation. There are certain things that can change radically your interpretation of an event. When that commanding officer told his soldiers, smile, it changed palpably the tension, hostility. That is the power of laughter. It changes the mood. In the negative side, it's leitzonis, it's damaging, it's dangerous. Used as a tool, as a productive tool, it is a very key to being a successful person, because the same point, as a mood regulator, when I'm down and depressed, nothing means anything, and then I laugh, and I'm back to my joyful, optimistic sense, that is a tool you need to use. When there's tension, when there's hostility, and you can make a joke and people laugh, the mood changes. No longer is there a contentious environment, now it's friendly, it's comfortable. Utilizing a sense of humor is a key to a successful human being. And I have this as a Masorah from my Rebbe. Over and over the Rishiva would talk about it, and over he would stress it. And I'd like to close with an interesting story that I think well illustrates this concept. A number of years ago, there was a bank robbery in France. And it was a very, very carefully planned, skillfully executed robbery. What happened was that there was a large bank vault, a sewer system ran under the bank. These number of criminals floated a raft down into the sewer system. They had, I guess, what they would call mobile generators, and they had jackhammers that they piled through the cement underneath the vault. They began breaking through. They entered through a large hole that they dug in underneath the vault. And they climbed into this vault. Now, it was so well and carefully planned, they did this on a 3-day holiday. And they were in that vault for the 3 days, and they broke into half of the safe deposit boxes in that vault. And they stole an unimaginable, and in fact, unaccountable amount of jewelry, gold, cash, because they were all in private safe deposit boxes. And they escaped without leaving a single fingerprint. Interesting enough, the next day when the bank reopened, what they found besides the large hole in the floor, they found the raft, they found picnic baskets, they found wine bottles emptied out, corkscrews. These guys were having a party. They weren't just there for 3 days. They had picnic lunches, they had wine, they were drinking, they were sleeping. And I was once discussing this story with a young fellow who said to me, wow, what a great mushel, what a great parable for life. I said, what do you mean? What do you see from that? And I said, look at those guys, what idiots they were. They were in the vault for 3 days. They're drinking wine, they're partying, they're sleeping. If they would have worked more diligently, they would, instead of half the safe deposit box, they could have broken into 3/4. They would have gotten all that gold and all that wealth. Isn't that a great mushel for life? We're here, we have a few short years, and we're lazy, we sleep, we drink wine. If we'd understand the value of our time, we'd live very differently. Now, at the time, I couldn't be as stark with that fellow as I'm going to say it now. But that attitude is the attitude of an immature person. And I'll explain to you why. Had those robbers done exactly as he counseled, you know what would have happened? They would have stayed up late, been very austere, very serious, and they would have made a mistake. You can't work 72 hours straight without slipping up once, without one time touching someone without your glove, leaving a fingerprint, leaving some evidence. And the only way you could work for 3 days is if you take breaks, you drink a little bit of wine, you take it easy, you enjoy yourself, because then the human being is at its peak efficiency. And if you push it, and if you over push it, even though you're digging for diamonds and gold, invariably you'll make a mistake, you'll err, and they would have gotten caught. And that, my friends, I believe is actually a very apt mushal for life. And that mushal is that we should take life very, very seriously. Life is this one golden opportunity, in fact, the only opportunity in our life, to accomplish, to grow, and every moment of life is precious. And whilst that's true, it is also a wise man who sits back every once in a while, takes it slow, and takes a sort of light approach to life, learns to laugh, because if you don't do that, you will fail. You will engage in many disastrous relationships. You'll get angry at people. You'll blow it in a big way. Because in your attempt to be focused and driven, what you're going to do is make many, many mistakes. And training yourself to sit back a little bit, take it easy, laugh, tell a joke, have a lighthearted attitude is a very key ingredient in a successful life. Why? It's not that I don't value life, it's quite the opposite. I understand I'm a human. These are the needs of a human. If I walk about with a healthy, happy attitude, I'm much more efficient, much more effective. If I focus on the value of life and become so hyper-focused, I will hurt many other people. I will hurt myself. My moods will not allow me to be efficient and effective. And one of the keys to living that successful life is learning to laugh, learning to enjoy the moment. And from my Rosh Hashiva, from my Rebbe, I have a Masorah that that is one of the keys to living a successful life. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom and the understanding to put this into practice.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozin free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.